Oh, good morning, guys. I'm so happy to be here with you guys. Today is my first day of my vacation. I got to sleep last night like a normal human being. I didn't have to be out on the streets, like, driving around. So, yep. In the streets. And I got a lot of time to, like, after the drag racers go home, I was on the desk, and I was able to, like, study this word during those quiet hours before everybody gets up and starts going to work and people start saying, like, I've had a car accident. So I've been working on this one for a while. I'm gonna take you guys on a journey this morning through the book of Daniel. If you're familiar with it, cool. I think you're gonna discover some new things that you never heard before or ever noticed before in the story. If you have no idea what I just said or who I'm talking about, don't worry, I'm not gonna gloss over things. We're gonna tell the story today so that everybody can be on the same page and understand what's going on. Okay? So just like me, I always got to give background. Okay? If you guys are familiar with the Bible, you know that there's this nation of Israel. They have a long history, started with a family that God chose. He brings them out. He's going to have them be his people, that he's going to bring this promised Messiah, this Savior that's going to save the world. It's going to come through this family. Well, like families do, keep having children, more children, they grow into a big nation. And they have this up and down turbulent history where, hey, we love you, God. Oh, we hate you, God. We love idols. Oh, we love you, God. And they come back and forth. Well, finally, like, God puts down the ultimatum and he's like, if you guys continue to choose these idols over me, I'm going to have other nations come in and destroy your nation. They're going to take you back into captivity. God had already freed them from the Egyptians before. They were slaves for over 400 years. But he said, something like that's going to happen again. Well, they're like, okay, we'll be serious. And God gives them more time and more time and more time. And just like the human heart is, eventually becomes callous towards God. And then this nation, the nation of Babylon, which has risen to power, comes in and takes people from Israel and takes them captive. Now they leave like a puppet king on the throne in Judah for a while, but eventually they try to think that they can rebel against this king called Nebuchadnezzar, and then he's like, yeah, not happening. And God actually supports him and has like the temple destroyed and everything, and it looks bad. Well, that's where our story picks up here, and it's going to focus on four young Jewish boys, because King Nebuchadnezzar, when he comes over and he takes over this nation, he tells his assistants, he's like, I want you to go in there and I want you to find the brightest, smartest young men, and I want you to bring them here to the capital city with me, where we're going to train them up and we're going to have them be advisors and wise men in our own courts. We're going to use our enemy's people to make our nation greater and stronger and better. So they go and they discover these four boys that were all from the nation of Judah, and God even gives their names here. The first one was Daniel. He's going to be our main character. But he's got his three friends that God is also going to use and develop to be his, like, witness in Babylon. And their names in Hebrew were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, the story is going to refer to them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because when these boys get taken over, Babylon is going to try to take their identity, throw it in the garbage, and give them a new Babylonian identity. So when they get to this nation, they're given new names. Daniel's name is changed to Belteshazzar, which means Marduk. That was their god that they worshiped. They had multiple gods. Marduk, protect the king. Where Daniel in Hebrew means God is my judge. So they try to take his Jewish identity and erase it, expunge it from him. Now these boys would have gone into this school. They would have had to learn how to write. The writing system was crazy difficult. You are all familiar with, like, Chinese characters. If you've ever tried to read them, you're like, yeah, they just look like more windows to me with crosses. That's how difficult theirs was. They had over 600 characters that they had to learn when they would study this school, learn to speak Aramaic, no longer speaking their language in this school. So they had 3 years to go through this progression where they're now going to be ready to serve in the king's courts. But God does some pretty amazing things to these boys, even though they're now captives in this foreign country. He prepares them for be a light in this nation. One of the first, like, hints that you know that God is about to do something really great is here in the first chapter. And it says that God had given these boys, like, exceptional wisdom, like unusual understanding. And it was something that, yeah, they might have been great on their own, but they became even greater because of what God did and provided for them. Now, here's the thing. I grew up in the Christian church. I heard these stories since I was a little kid. I've heard other pastors preach on this book over and over and over again. And it usually comes down to something like this. Daniel was awesome. You should try to be awesome like Daniel. But we need to slow down, rewind, look closer at the story that's happening. It says that God gave these. Can you show that slide, Neil? That verse? God gave these four young men an unusual aptitude. It means that God was the one providing the life and power for these boys to become who they were supposed to be. They didn't become great or wonderful because of something that was in them. It was something that God put in them. So they get there and they're part of this training school. And the boys are looking at, they're given like this food. And Daniel and his friends look at this food. And for some unknown reason, they're like, we can't eat this food. A lot of people have given theories like, oh, it's because it has, they said, the meat and the wine of the king's stores. Well, it wasn't against God's law for Hebrews to drink wine. There was only a Nazirite vow for a select certain amount of people who said that they wouldn't cut their hair or drink wine, but that wasn't the entire nation. It was never part of God's law. And they could eat a lot of kinds of meats. So it wasn't the fact that it was meat necessarily, but for some reason they're like, they know, they sense from God's spirit like, hey, I know that they're here to indoctrinate us and make us Babylonian people, but there's just some things that God says, like, not that. So they say this and they're like, what are we going to do? We're supposed to eat this. And so Daniel goes up to the master, like the person in charge of their schooling. And it says that God had given this chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. So Daniel already has God turning this man's heart towards him. Then he goes to him and said, hey, would it be a problem if we just, instead of eating this food provided by the king, we have our own like vegetables and water. That's just something for us, a way for us to worship our God. And even though the man wants to, he's like, oh, if you guys show up in front of the king and he sees that you look sick and pale, he's going to kill me. Like, he's going to have my head. I don't know if I can do that. So Daniel gets his answer from that chief of staff. And then he goes to a lower attendant. He's like, hey, would you just let us try just for 10 days? Let us just have, feed us vegetables and water. And if we don't look, if we're starting to get sick and pale, you can stop. But they trust God that God is going to do something to them. So they get it. They get the vegetables and water. And after those 10 days, they look really good. Like really good. And a lot of people, when they take this story and they look at this, they're like, you see, I knew I should go on a diet. And there's even been churches that have written entire books called the Daniel Diet, and they're like, you need more fiber. And that's what they say. But this wasn't written to a scientific American audience about the benefits of including more vegetables in your diet. This was written to point to someone in a person, point about God. This story has Daniel's name on the front of the letter, but it's God's story. And God has provided us something more wonderful than vegetables. He's provided us the power and the spirit of God. And that's what you're seeing here in this story, not just because they made better food choices. So God is preparing these young men to be noticed by the king. And he does. They look so much more robust than the others. And so when the king examines them, he brings them in and he's asking them questions. And this is like your job interview. You do well, hey man, you're going to be put in this high position. And these boys impress the king so much that he even says, these Judah boys are 10 times better than all the rest. And again, it's because God gave them his wisdom. He gave them his understanding, because God's planting and preparing his people to be in this ungodly kingdom so they can be a light for him. Well, so they get accepted into the court. They get put on the king's staff. And then we go to the next chapter. So it's like scenes of a movie. Cut, and we're on to the next one. One night, King Nebuchadnezzar wakes up and he has a horrible nightmare. So he calls in all of his wise men, fortune teller, magicians, and asked them to come in. He's like, I've had a horrible dream. Tell me what it is. And all of the wise men are like, they're used to interpreting these signs and symbols for the king. It's not a problem for them. They do that all the time. But this time the king won't tell them what the dream was. And so they're like, sir, my lord, if you could only just give us a hint. Let us know what it is. We can interpret it for you. And he's like, liars. I know what you're doing. You're stalling for time because you're just going to make up some story and then you're going to go on and spin all this stuff and you're going to try to confuse me until I give up, and I'm not doing that. If you don't tell me what it is, and then the king utters one of his favorite phrases, I'm going to tear you limb from limb. And so they're freaking out and they're like, sir, your highness, only the gods could tell you what your dreams are, and they don't live here among men. But Daniel knows that there is a God who is close, and he can interpret this. Well, Daniel hears these words, because it doesn't seem from the story that he was there that night in the court, but he gets wind that the king says, kill them all. So he tells that to his chief of soldiers. He's like, prepare to kill all the wise men, magicians, fortune tellers. What is it to this king? He rules like almost the entire world. He'll just get more. He'll get rid of this batch, get a new batch. But Daniel goes to the commander and asks him, like, what's happening? What's going on? And he tells him, the king wants to kill all of you. He's like, can I go talk to the king? So Daniel goes and talks to the king. He said, sir, would you give us just a couple days so that we can pray about this, so that we can ask God what the interpretation of your dream is. And the king gives him that time. So Daniel goes back to his friends, his three other Hebrew friends, and is like, guys, we need to pray. No human can determine and tell and interpret what this dream is. We need to ask God. So they do, and they go back. And that night, God reveals to Daniel in a vision the dream that the king has. So quickly he runs back to the official Arioch, who's like in the commander in charge of the soldiers, like, God told me what it is. Well, this guy wastes no time, because he actually, you can tell from the story, he doesn't want to kill all of these wise men. Grabs him, takes to the king, sir, he's ready. He's got something to tell you. So the king is like, all right, let's see what you got, Daniel. And he's like, sir, it's not me. No human can tell you what I'm about to tell you, but the God who's alive and real in heaven and close can tell you what your dream is. So he starts to tell him, he's like, you had a dream about this statue, and it had five layers to it, and it was gold and silver and gold, silver, and iron, and then down to the feet, iron and clay. And you had this dream, and I'm here to tell you that that's about five kingdoms. Your kingdom is like the gold, but then a lesser kingdom is going to come and usurp you, take you over. And he tells him all of the stuff that's going to happen. And eventually he says, there's going to be a sixth kingdom not pictured in your dream. And this kingdom and this king is going to come, and this kingdom is going to last forever and be greater than any of those previous kingdoms ever were. So it's kind of like a prophecy. It doesn't happen in that specific moment, but the fact that he was able to tell the king what his dream was lets the king know, wow, here's something else, Daniel. Whatever God you serve must be pretty amazing. And at that point, the king bows down and tries to worship Daniel because of that. He even has his people bring in incense and sacrifices. And in Daniel's honor, he has them do these sacrifices in front of Daniel. Just like Pastor Burrow said earlier, we're here at Santos Church to know God, not just know about God. Well, at this point, King Nebuchadnezzar knows a little about God, but he doesn't know God yet by any means. So because of this, Daniel is like appointed to a much, much higher position. And all King Nebuchadnezzar knows is that this God of the Hebrews, he must be pretty amazing, but he's not fully convinced yet that he needs to worship him. Well, the next scene goes on to chapter 3. We don't know where Daniel is in this next story. He could have been somewhere else in the kingdom on business. But Nebuchadnezzar, his heart's not changed. He decides, I'm going to build a 90-foot gold statue, and I'm going to have everybody in my kingdom bow down and worship it. So they build this furnace. They build this statue. have it made, covered with gold, put it up in the center of the area on this plain, this flat ground. And he has all the officials come, and he's like, when you hear the music, I want you to bow down and worship, or I'm going to tear you limb from limb. And like I said, it's his favorite phrase. These kings, man, the power goes to their head. And so we know that Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're there at this meeting with all the other officials. The music plays. Everybody bows down except them. Well, these other magicians and wise men, they see this as their opportunity. They're like, look, they're not bowing down. Let's go tattle. Let's go tell the king. So they go and they tell the king, oh, king, remember that little ceremony we had? Well, guess who didn't bow down? Your favorite little Jewish advisors. Oh, really? Says the king. Bring them here. So at this affront to the power, the king brings them forth, and he gives them a chance to save face. He's like, maybe you didn't understand. Maybe your Babylonian is as good as I thought it was. But basically, I want you to bow down and worship this statue. Are you going to do it? And instead of arguing with the king, they tell him plainly, they said, sorry, sir, we can't do it. We can't worship this statue. But our God is able to save us. We know he will rescue us. And even if we don't bow down and we perish in these flames, we're never going to bow down and worship this false idol. The king's face, it says in the story that his face gets so contorted. Like, you know how, like, if your mom ever really got angry at you, but like 10 times worse, the anger is just so much. And he's like, throw him in the fire. So this furnace that was used to probably make this statue, he's going to have him chucked in. And it says in the story that he doesn't even waste any time. He doesn't take off their turbans or their robes or their pants. He has them bound by his strongest men, and he orders the furnace to be made 7 times hotter. So these strongest soldiers of the kings pick them up, take them over, and as they're throwing them in, the flames are so hot that the men who are there to throw them in the fire die from the heat, from the fire. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego fall into the fire, and the king is thinking, I showed them. Then the king is looking at the fire. And he looks and he turns to his officials. Didn't we just throw 3 guys in there? And they're like, yes, sir. 3. We're sure. He's like, but I see 4. And weren't they tied up? But now they're walking around. And he says, and he looks at this 4th person. And this is your big clue for the story. You can't gloss over this. He says, and the 4th looks like a god. So the king goes as close to the furnace as possible. And obviously the heat must have been so intense that it killed some of his soldiers. And he says, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, come on out. Come on out. So they come out. Not a single hair on their head is singed at all. Their clothes don't even smell like smoke. You guys have been around a campfire, and then you come home, and then you take your shirt off, and you're like, oh, you smell it, right? It's just on you. It's permeating. These guys, nothing. The 4th man, who looks like a god, doesn't come out of the fire, but the 3 do. And he's like, King Nebuchadnezzar's like, your God is amazing. There's no other god that can rescue you like this. Again, he has this encounter, and he just sees whoever your God is, he is something else. He's different than any other false, fake god that I've ever worshipped. But it's still not enough to convince the king. He even says to them, using his favorite phrase, he makes a decree right then and there. Whoever says anything bad about their God, guess what's going to happen to them? Now, if this was like most of us Christians, we'd be like, oh, government's got our back? Oh, awesome. But look at this story. Look at the other Bible stories. When does the Christian faith spread and really take heart in people's lives and go throughout the nation? It's with opposition, not during times where we have a persecutor behind us. So that happens, and then we go to the next scene. And I call this next chapter Wild Man. God isn't just passionate about using Daniel and his three friends to be a light. God actually loves King Nebuchadnezzar as well, cares about his heart. But King Nebuchadnezzar has a lot of pride. Well, he has another nightmare. Daniel comes in. God gives the interpretation to Daniel. It's about this tree that was growing up really great, and then it's cut down, and then it ends by an angel from heaven coming and saying, you're going to be like a wild man who's going to be eating grass from the fields, and it's all this craziness. And then Daniel's really sad because he's like, I wish this wasn't true, sir. But God's talking about you. He says that you're going to be roving like a wild man eating grass. Well, time goes by. King Nebuchadnezzar, he's walking on his rooftop, which at that time, Babylon was known for its beautiful hanging gardens that covered the whole city. And it was just like one of the wonders of the world at that time. And the king is looking at everything that he has done, all of his money. He's built this beautiful metropolis city. And he's like, look what I did. I'm pretty awesome. I'm a big deal. I'm pretty awesome. I should be praised quite often, with like a lot. And God hears him from heaven and sees his pride. And he says, hey, King Nebuchadnezzar, remember that dream I gave you? Today it's coming true. And at that point, King Nebuchadnezzar loses his mind, flees society, and is forced out into the fields and the wild places, and literally lives like an animal. God says that he gave him the mind of an animal, starts eating grass, and he was gone for a long time. The story says seven periods of time. How long is that? We don't really know, but long enough that his hair becomes as long as eagle's feathers, and his fingernails, it doesn't show it in this picture, become long like bird's claws. And the whole time his kingdom is dormant, other people are ruling it, and the king is literally, can you imagine being a farmer and you're just like, did I just see Bigfoot? Well, that's King Nebuchadnezzar out eating grass with our sheep. And he lives like this until one day he looks up to heaven and God restores his mind. And his officials come out and find him and they bring him back. And God actually allows King Nebuchadnezzar to be restored to even greater glory than he originally was. Well, King Nebuchadnezzar has this experience and he writes down his testimony and he sends it throughout the entire Babylonian kingdom and known world at that time. And he says that he tells the story of what happened. He's like, this is what I said and this is what God told me. And then he says, he's like, I, he owns it. I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and glorify and honor the King of heaven. Finally humbled, but finally convinced for himself that he just doesn't need to allow others to worship this God. He needs to worship this God for himself. I would not be surprised when we get to heaven if you see King Nebuchadnezzar there, based on this story of how his heart's changed, where he was convinced that he needed to trust in God. So it doesn't end there. Daniel's story doesn't end there. Now, if you're counting and you're really good at math, you're like, 1, 2, 3, 4, skip, 6. We're going to skip a chapter. Not because it's not awesome, but because we just won't have enough time today. But if you want to go back and read about the writing hand on the wall, the second king of Babylon, something that will help you, and people get confused. Like, I even had to look this up. I was like, how many kings does Daniel serve under? Because he's in captivity for like 70 years. Well, he serves under 3 different kingdoms and 4 different kings, because God would, remember that statue with the gold and the silver? Well, the second kingdom comes and usurps Babylon. And then this second kingdom is called Media, and it's called the Medes and King Darius. Now, this is Daniel's most famous story, Daniel in the Lion's Den. This is the one that we always teach the little children, okay? But I want you to back off and not jump and assume that you know everything that's about to happen in this story. Well, the evil men who were also on leadership under the king, who tried to get Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego killed when they didn't bow down the statue, have also been trying for a long time to get Daniel killed. They can't stand him. And they look at his life and they're like, this guy never messes up. I've never seen him cheat. I've never seen him lie. How are we going to get him? And one of them comes up with the idea, like, we're going to trip him up It's got to be with his relationship with God. That's how we're going to get him in trouble. So they mosey into the king's quarters one day, and they're like, "Hey, sir, just got a little idea. You're a pretty awesome king. Maybe we should make a law that says for the next 30 days, everybody has to pray to you and nobody else." The king's like, "Oh, sounds like a great idea." Signs it into law. And in Mede law, once the king signs something, it can be undone. Even the king can't take it back. So he has to think about things before he signs them into law. And then the officials are like, "Roll off that stone," like, "Thank you, sir. We'll be praying to you just tonight." Well, they head to Daniel's house. Daniel, by surely had heard about this new law. And he goes to pray to God for help.
What do I do?
And then his officials know that he had this habit of praying three times a day. So he's opening up the window, he's facing Jerusalem, and he's just probably just pouring out his heart to God. And along come this corrupt group of officials, and they're looking, they're like, "Got him, right there." So they go back to the king, and they tell him, like, "Sir, remember that law you just signed into law a little bit ago? Funny little fact, your favorite guy, Daniel boy, over there is not praying to you, he's praying to his God." And the king is heartbroken. He's heartbroken. He's like, he realized that he's been tricked by these officials. He realizes there's nothing he can do, thinks about it. So Daniel's brought back to the palace, and they're going to throw him in this pit with lions, where the lions would rip people and tear them apart. So Daniel's put in this pit. They put a big stone over it, and the king comes along and seals that stone with his special seal, sealing Daniel's death. But that night, all the officials can tell that the king is really upset. So they're like, bring in his nightly entertainment. He doesn't want any of it. He doesn't even want his normal food. He's so upset and heartbroken about his friend Daniel being sent to death that he stays up all night. Now in the morning when he comes out, he's like coming to the tomb and hope against hope. Maybe somehow Daniel's God saved him. So he comes in, he's like, "Daniel, are you alive? Did your God save you?"
He's listening.
And he hears Daniel's voice and said, "Yes, my Lord. God sent his angel. He closed the lion's mouth. I'm all right. I haven't done any wrong. God has proven me." And it says in the story that Daniel was saved because he trusted in God. Now, something I don't want you to get tripped up in. You know how with most Bible characters, it'll be going really good, and then the Bible will tell us some huge moral failing they had. Moses had it, David had it, others. But in this story, it doesn't highlight anything that Daniel ever did wrong. But don't get the idea that Daniel was sinless. When it talks about that he was a man of like upstanding character, it just means generally he was a godly man. But he wasn't God. He wasn't Jesus. So he pulls Daniel out, and he's alive. He says that he doesn't even have a single scratch on him. Well, the king then turns and looks at the officials who just tricked him, and I'm sure they're shaking in their boots like, "Oh, crap." The king's like, "Them, their wives and their children, now." So they go back to their houses, gather all of their family members. They're like, "What's happening, you know?" And it says that the lions were so eager to kill them that as they were thrown into the pit, they didn't even hit the ground before the lions jumped up, grabbed them, probably like a pit bull, and just tore them apart, limb from limb. So that's where we're going to end our story here. Like, there's a lot of chapters I just covered, okay? I want you to, when you guys look at this story, it's called Daniel, but this story of Daniel is actually whispering Jesus. That's who this story is really about, and who you're really supposed to see in this story. I want to rewind and let's go back over some of the things that you may or may not have seen. So it says that God gave these boys wisdom, that they were 10 times more capable. Do you remember when Jesus was growing up, and one day he's in the temple? He's gone to Jerusalem with his family, and he's talking with the religious leaders, and they're just astounded at this boy who has so much understanding of Scripture? Daniel was a foreshadow of what Jesus would be like. Do you remember when it says that I just told you that Daniel said he lived like a blameless life, man of godly character, but he wasn't God? That was because the one who would be the Messiah would be truly sinless and truly perfect. Do you remember when the jealous leaders tried to get Daniel and his friends killed, and they came up with a plan to get him captured and arrested and sent to his death? Do you remember when people, the religious leaders, came up with a plan to get Jesus arrested and sent to his death, but it actually worked and Jesus was killed? How about this? Do you remember when King Darius was really reluctant to even send Daniel to the lion's den? Didn't want him to be. He knew he was innocent. He knew that he had been tricked. Do you remember when Pontius Pilate was also reluctant to send Jesus to his death because he knew that Jesus was innocent? And then do you see how Daniel was thrown into a pit and there was a big stone put over it and it was sealed? Do you remember when Jesus was laid in the tomb and it was sealed with a large stone? Do you remember when Daniel was miraculously spared by God? He came out without a scratch. Jesus was brought back to life, but he didn't come out with scratches. He came out with holes in his hands and his feet, scars on his back. But God still brought him out alive. And then when Daniel was freed, and I forgot to tell you this, when he was freed out of that lion's den, the king actually exalted him to an even higher position with greater glory. When Jesus came out of that grave, God exalted him to the highest place with the highest glory. God doesn't just tell Bible stories because it's something that he wants children to fall asleep to at night. God tells his stories because he wants you to hear him whisper the name of Jesus. Think about that story. Who was that fourth man in the fire? It doesn't explicitly say. All we can see is the observable behavior. Somebody who saves his people from fire. Somebody who breaks our binds. Somebody who allows us to come out without a single scratch. What kind of person does this? Who can do that? I have this little, like, if you go to the next slide, Janelle, just a little something to read. It said, the fourth man in the fire was our man on the cross, who makes us unbound, feel untouched by the flame. His hand blocks death's fight, and he's the last king that ever was. He's that last kingdom that Daniel was talking about, that everlasting kingdom, that King Nebuchadnezzar finally acknowledged and began to worship. And because he was the first raised to eternal life, he is worthy. So the Lamb of God goes in the tomb, but then out comes the king. I want you to look at this little picture. I had to have a computer help me make it because I can't do this. I can't draw this. But I want to leave you with this picture. I want you to see just who really is that we're worshiping. It took King Nebuchadnezzar time after time before he finally realized who that fourth man in the fire was, who this person he was seeing save these lives. No matter how much he wanted to show his power and his glory, he had to bow to something greater than himself. And the whole time, these four Jewish boys were putting their faith in a God who was alive, who was close. The man said, only the gods can interpret your dreams, and they're up way in heaven. But Daniel knew that God was close with him and was with him there in Babylon, just like he's here with us in southwest Detroit, in Trenton, downriver, east side, up in the burbs. God is with us, and he's close. So I think, how do you, Daniel lived 70 years in Babylon. From as far as we know, he never returned back to his home in Jerusalem. How do you think Daniel would define freedom? I think he would define it in this way. It's being empowered by God to be the person that he was created to be in whatever context he was placed in, whether back in Israel or in Babylon. No matter who his superior is and who he has to serve in his place of employment, it'd be empowered by God to be the person you were created to be. That is true freedom. As much as he might have longed for fish from the Sea of Galilee, to speak his own language, to wear his own clothing, to be in his own environment and run through the hills of Jerusalem again, he was content to allow God to be alive through him where he was at that given moment. I think that Daniel discovered that an identity that he had was greater than his Jewish ancestry. I think he discovered that he was a child of God, which supersedes anything that could have ever been given to him in his home in Israel. I think that's the same thing that you and I need to discover, and God can help us discover. That's greater than becoming more religious. That's greater than changing your diet. That's greater than praying three times a day in a window. That's true aliveness when God brings you home. And I think that Daniel lived in Babylon like he was already home in heaven with Jesus. I think that's his real secret. Not that, I'm going to be a good person. I'm going to always make sure that I'm really polite and respectful to whoever's like in charge of me. I think that Daniel realized that I'm in Babylon, but I'm already living in that sixth kingdom, that everlasting kingdom. My real king is not King Nebuchadnezzar or King Darius or whoever else. My real king is Jesus. That's who I'm serving. So how do we live like we're already home, wherever we live in this context? Well, let me tell you some ways that I don't think we live like we're home. One is any kind of habit modification, which is really popular in all kinds of religious circles throughout the world. I'm talking about you're I need to stop cussing. I need to stop these addictions. I need to stop this. And if I can just be free from those things, then I'll really be free. But remember, Daniel didn't change his location. He still had these things over him that would be considered binding, or he wasn't free in the sense of the way you and I think. He was free because he was free to be who God had made him to be in that context. That doesn't mean that God doesn't ever allow us to be free from our addictions, but seeking those things and focusing on those things is not returning to our identity. It's not being empowered by God. It's just trying to deal with a problem. You could quit your habit. You could give up a secret sin, but what have you replaced it with? Have you received life from God? Or you've just a vacuum, emptiness? If you watch, I watch and observe all the time. I hear people talk, coworkers, my marriage failed. I found out that my wife was cheating on me, so I'm getting a divorce. And how do they deal with that? How do they heal from that? It's always the same thing. They're like, man, I'm just going to take time to work on myself. I'm gonna reflect, step back, And it's always the same thing. It's like, I'm going to start exercising. I'm going to get sexy again. I'm gonna go find somebody new. No, I'm serious. This is literally the conversations I have in the scout car with them as we're driving around. And it's like, but don't you see? You're missing something, a big something, especially since you're looking for life from within yourself. Nebuchadnezzar had way more life than you ever did, and it was nothing. What do you think the lowest point of King Nebuchadnezzar's life was? Was it when he was out in the field eating grass like an animal? I would say no. I would say it was the entire time that he was separated from God was the lowest point in his life. So you can look real good in all of these nice clothing. You can have all this power. And you can even be out in the field dirty and nasty. It's the same thing. Because you don't have God. So how do we live like we're already home? I said it's not habit modification. It's not getting more religious. If you grew up in a really religious background, that's probably things that you've tried before. You come back from a conference and you're like, I'm going to do better. You're like, I'm going to make a Bible reading plan. I'm going to do all of these things. I'm finally going to serve in children's ministry. And you're going to come back. You can do all the right things But if you don't have the right view behind it, it all becomes emptiness. It all becomes meaningless activity that has a very spiritual appearance to it. And you, those of you who've tried it before, you know it doesn't work. And then you go for a while and you're just like, why didn't it work? I feel so sad. And then time goes along and along comes another motivational speaker and they're like, try harder again. You're like, okay, go, I'll try harder again. And then you get back up and it's the same thing. You're like, I don't understand. How do I find freedom from this cycle? It's because no matter how much you try to drum up something and generate life within yourself through activity, if it's you who's trying to generate it, like pedaling a bicycle, you're going to wear out. You're going to find out you don't have the power in you to create life. You need somebody who can pour life into you. Receiving something is way better than trying to generate and create something on your own. So the person who says, my marriage failed, I'm just going to work on myself, they're hopping on that bicycle. They're hopping on that hamster wheel, trying to think, if I just run harder and improve things, things will somehow get better. What we need to have is something to plug into, a source that can give us unlimited life. And that's Jesus. That's who Daniel was plugging into. That's why he prayed, to plug into things, not so that he could impress God with his daily like prayer quota status. Another thing I want you to remember is it's not about more surrender. Receiving life and finding home is not about the more things that you give up. And what do I mean by that? Because if the focus is on me and what I need to do, I'm not going to be focused on God and what he has done and what he's trying to do through me. I'm just going to be focused with everything that's external. The words that come in my mouth, the thoughts that are in my head, everything is from here up. And God is like, I want to start here and have my life pour out from you. So what is the answer? I told you some things it's not. I want to tell you a story. And this story, I didn't make this story. This was a story that I saw as a kid from an old film. Those of you who are into TikTok and like Instagram today, who like little 5 seconds, you probably could never watch this movie because for the first like 45 minutes, there's no talking. It's just, yeah. It's just all visuals. I'm not going to play the movie. Don't get nervous. I'm just going to tell you about it. So this movie is called The Black Stallion. It was made in the 70s. And it's about this boy. He's on a ship. Oh, okay. Should we have a watch party? This boy, he's on this ship. And one day he's wandering the ship and he hears this noise. And he finds that in one of the holding cells, there's this Arabian horse. And it's wild and crazy, and that's it. He's very curious about it, but he doesn't know much about it. Well, the ship catches fire and goes down. And you better not tell me that I ruined the story, because literally this movie's like 50 years old. You had your chance to watch it. The ship goes down, and the boy is thrown overboard, and everybody else perishes, but not this boy. The horse is swimming there in the water. He's able to grab onto one of the reins or the ropes, and the horse swims all night. And takes him and the boy to an island. So the boy lives, and he ends up on this island. And I'm going to be skipping parts. But eventually the boy sees the horse, comes, tries to like build some sort of relationship with it. And the horse eventually starts to trust him. And the boy wants to ride the horse. But he's just a little boy, and this horse's back is all the way up here. So he convinces the horse to come out into the water with him of the ocean. And then he's able to swim up and get on top of the horse's back. And he tries to he comes out of the water and tries running and running, and then he falls off because he's not trained with riding a horse. So he just repeats this process over and over and over again until finally he's gotten good at riding. He's able to lift his arms up. And you can show that picture, Janelle. He's able to lift his arms up and ride freely there on the beachfront. Now the boy is eventually rescued by some fishermen, and they bring his horse with them. And he takes his horse back to America in the suburbs. So here he is back home. All his creature comforts, except now he has an Arabian stallion in his backyard. And I won't tell you more of the story, but when I saw that movie and I was reading Daniel, and I was just like, man, what would it feel like to be so free in this captivity environment But because you know who you are and who is living in you, you find freedom in any given day at any given moment because of that identity and that power. And I remembered this movie, the boy coming out of the water, and just the freedom he must have felt being able to get on that powerful horse and ride it. A lot of you have gotten baptized and you come out the water and you're like, what's next? It's not walking on a dry, deserted beach. It's time to ride. God has given us this powerful spirit inside of us, and he wants us to take the mane in our fingers and hold on and let him run throughout our life. That's the kind of life that God has for you. Isn't that so much greater than increasing the amount of religious activity in your life? Trying to improve your diet, trying to look and, you know, earn more money. God wants to live throughout for you right where you are. That's all. I'm going to close there because it's been going. This is a lot that we're going through today. But I want to leave you with that last idea. I want to leave you with that last picture. If you want to talk about more about horse riding, we can talk about it later. We can talk about what it means to walk with the Spirit. But that's the image I want to leave with you. That's the life that God has called us to and prepared us for. Just like that lion came out of the grave, the King is now living and resting and living in our hearts. And that's the same person that wants to live through us. All right. I'm going to stop there because I keep going.
That's good.
You guys have been awesome. Thank you.